Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. Did you like the new music we have? We've made a lot of changes on the show. We're really upping our game. If you didn't know, we are now officially on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can also listen directly on our website, ChinaUnscripted.com. But, you know, it's not just me on the show. Why don't you guys say hello?
Hi, I'm Shelley.
And I'm Matt.
But you guys all knew that because you're all huge fans of this show.
And you listen to every one of our podcasts.
All number eights of them.
This is number eight, so let's get started.
Good news, everyone. We're in another Cold War.
And I thought July was hot.
Oh.
Please don't click away. It gets better than this from here. I promise. So
I don't.
So this Cold War is with China. So get ready for your James Bond versus China movies. But specifically, that is a statement made by Michael Collins, the deputy assistant director of the CIA's East Asia Mission Center. We actually have a clip of that.
By their own terms, and what Xi Jinping himself enunciates, I would argue by definition, no, John McLaughlin raised this issue early in describing Russia, but what they're waging against us is fundamentally a Cold War. A Cold War not like we saw during the Cold War, but a Cold War by definition, a country that exploits all avenues of power, licit and illicit, public and private, economic, military, to undermine the standing of your rival relative to, you know, your own standing, without resorting to conflict.
And that follows statements from the FBI director, Christopher Wray, earlier this week that said, China is the most challenging and most significant threat to the United States.
Well, I think China, from a counterintelligence perspective, in many ways represents the broadest, most challenging, most significant threat we face as a country. And I say that because for them, it is a whole-of-state effort. It is economic espionage as well as traditional espionage. It is non-traditional collectors as well as traditional intelligence operatives. It's human sources as well as cyber means. We have economic espionage investigations in every state, all 50 states.
So how do you guys feel about these new pretty upfront statements by the United States intelligence sector about China and a threat?
I would say that they've been watching China Uncensored.
Do you think they'll fund us?
If only we could get funding from the CIA.
Yeah. Why not? But actually, I think it was interesting because I was surprised.
Why were you surprised?
I was surprised even though... Okay, so the context is the Aspen Institute is having their annual security forum right now. So a lot of these people are speaking in panels, or like Christopher Wray was interviewed by Lester Holt from NBC, and that's when he made the comments about China being the greatest counterintelligence threat to the U.S. by far, and how the FBI has counterintelligence, like, investigations into Chinese operations in all 50 states.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, also said China is a he said we need to decide if China is a true adversary or a legitimate competitor.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. Well, when the Christopher Wray's comments came out, I actually first read about them on Twitter, and the reporters were surprised. And I was also kind of surprised. But then I realized that Wray had actually, this is not the first time he said this. He's said mm-hmm. the same thing in the spring when he was testifying in front of the Senate. And it seems like this is something that the U.S. intelligence community knows pretty well, since mm-hmm. the CIA is saying this. And Susan Thornton, who was like also in the government and like in the State Department dealing with China issues, said the same similar stuff at Aspen too. So the U.S. government knows that the Chinese Communist Party is a threat, but I think what I was surprised by what Gray said, because we don't talk about it that much in the media.
Well, I imagine that the U.S. government has understood the specific China threats for a long time.
Well, I think specific segments of the intelligence sector has, but by and large, I think a lot of, especially politicians, have not understood the severity of the problem.
I would say, yeah, there are certain politicians who do.
Yeah, and I think though what's happening now, because under the new administration, there's a lot of, I think, very good China experts who are part of the administration, who kind of have this bigger idea of how to take these individual specific security things that are happening and sort of wrap that into understanding how, okay, the Communist Party really is a very imminent threat. And not only do they understand it, and it's more widely understood, I think, in the current administration, but it's they're actually talking about it, whereas they just wouldn't talk about it, I think, under the Obama or Bush administrations.
This is when Shelley disagrees with Matt, and I love this part of the show.
I'm going to say that's not 100% true, because I think Obama's pivot to Asia was actually largely inspired by realizing that the Chinese threat was bigger.
Burn.
Well, no, I completely agree with that. The difference is that, you know, how often did people in the Obama administration say, we are pivoting to Asia because the Chinese Communist Party is a serious threat? It just was not nearly as much of an issue. And they might have said it a couple times, but my point is that it's essentially much more out of the open now than it was just a few years ago, even after the pivot to Asia.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, in the early years of the Bush administration, it did seem like the U.S. government was making a shift to focus on China. It seemed like they were focusing on that for, like, in 2000 and the first part of 2001.
It's like something happened that year that shifted American attention elsewhere.
Yeah.
Actually, that was interesting because they talked about it in this Aspen Security Forum panel about how the panel called China Rising. We'll put a link to it on YouTube, on our YouTube page below this this video. But they...
Old habits die hard.
Yes. Well, I mean, technically it's a video on YouTube. But they... somebody was talking about how the Chinese Communist Party was able to take advantage of the fact that the U.S. was looking elsewhere because of 9/11.
For those who couldn't figure out what we were talking about.
Yes. Because of 9/11 and then the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, like, we were distracted for a long time in the Middle East. And that's when they were able to, like, really kind of grow in a and advance a lot of the things that they were doing.
They were never challenged on any of these things. Like, I almost wonder, you know, Bill Clinton pushed for China to enter the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And I almost wonder if September 11th didn't happen, if people would have paid more attention to the ways China was manipulating that situation. And maybe we would not be in this current situation. We wouldn't be in a Cold War had people just kept their attention focused on China.
Or I think, well, so many things would be different if there had not been 9/11. So, yeah. I want to, like, watch the, like, alternate universe, like, TV show about what we would be currently doing if there was not 9/11. But
well, I can name one thing in particular, which is that the Americans rather quickly accepted a large amount of surveillance post 9/11 because the American public largely agreed that it was worth sacrificing a little bit of privacy for that feeling of security. What happened is, though, in the push to have more security in terms of everything from audio, video surveillance, and so on, the Communist Party took advantage of that and built a massive security system that, had 9/11 not happened and the CCP still tried to build the system, the rest of the world would have been very quickly like, whoa, 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 what are you doing? That's totally Orwellian 1984. Like, you can't do that. Western companies would have been called out a lot more for helping the CCP build this stuff. But the fact is that the whole world was willing to move towards mass surveillance, and that helped the CCP use it to essentially monitor its citizens in an extremely terrible way.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's not all bad. I mean, at least now we can get felt up at the airports. I mean, I'm not the only one who enjoys that, right? That human contact. I'm not the only one who's desperately alone, right?
We're all alone, Chris. Just some of us have higher standards than TSA.
Oh, now there's the burn. Well, Shelley, you mentioned earlier that you felt like the media does not cover this. Like there was the surprise that the CIA and the FBI would actually be talking about this.
Or I think because of all this, the focus on Russia right now, that like if you ask the average American on the street,
Russia is the biggest threat.
They would say Russia is the biggest threat, and the fact that I'm going to say that the head of the FBI and the CIA person who does Asia affairs, they probably know a little bit more about what's going on with China. That if they see China as the biggest threat, then that definitely says something.
Mm-hmm. Well, China is also better. Well, the Chinese Communist Party is also much better at soft power and propaganda and portraying China in a certain way to particularly the American public in a way that I think has, led people to, things like calling Xi Jinping or any Chinese leader president.
Right.
Well, I know people who think it's a democracy. I know people who watch my show, who are my friends that I've known for years, who think China is a democracy, and it makes me question.
Are you sure they're watching the show, Chris?
I think they're your friends, and you're like, you guys watch the show, right? And they're like, yeah, we totally do, Chris.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what the TSA agents say to me.
I think that what you said earlier about would we still be in a Cold War with China, I think we might still be in a Cold War, but I think the realization that this was happening, that we are in a Cold War with China, would have been much sooner.
Yeah. And it's interesting, this is following other countries in the world basically also coming to realize the very negative influence China is having on their countries, particularly Australia and New Zealand. And now it seems like the United States is finally catching up to this.
Well, I think, every time this comes up, people mention Australia and New Zealand, mm-hmm. and especially Australia, because the government, they just passed the foreign interference laws and the mm-hmm. the thing about not having foreign campaign contributions.
Bunch of racists.
I mean, the U.S. has had that since the 90s.
Bunch of racists.
But we want to be Australia and not New Zealand.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think, our experience in Australia and New Zealand was that Australia, there's a lot of discussion going on. The government seemed pretty woke about the issue. Mm-hmm. And the more that this kind of thing, light is shed on what's happening, the more it's exposed, the better that both the government and the people can kind of cope with the issue, right? And then you can have the debates about what the right thing is to do to counter that. But if nobody's talking about it, like New Zealand, then it's much more likely that the influence will go on. It will become harder to deal with it mm-hmm. In any way. So we want to be Australia. We want to expose what's going on with the Chinese Communist Party. We want to have this public debate about what to do about it.
And I think it's good that we're finally seeing research done in the United States about this. Australia had Clive Hamilton's book, Silent Invasion. New Zealand had Anne-Marie Brady's Magic Weapons. And when we were in D.C., we went to the Hudson Institute and heard a discussion about a new report called The Chinese Communist Party's Foreign Interference Operations, How the U.S. and Other Democracies Should Respond. So it's good to see that the U.S. finally has its major report exposing everything the Communist Party has been doing.
I think, but we're always learning more and more things.
Right. I mean, Christopher Wray just basically said that there are Communist Party influence operations in all 50 states.
Well, this really makes me happy. Like, we're going back to, the 1950s. There are communists everywhere. This is great. It's exciting. I know who I'm going to be for Halloween. McCarthy.
I think that, you bring up McCarthy, and obviously he has a very bad name. But I don't want to compare what Christopher Wray is saying to McCarthyism. Essentially, what Wray is saying is that there are a variety of tactics that the Chinese Communist Party is using. Some of them are actual spies, and some of them are overseas, business people or whatever, who are being influenced to various degrees. And through direct and indirect methods, the Communist Party is influencing things in, all 50 states, all across America. Mm-hmm. He's not saying, let's go kill a bunch of commies. And I think all the people in the administration are very careful to separate out. Like, we're not talking about overseas Chinese people. We're talking about the influence operations of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. Michael Collins, in the Aspen Security Forum panel, before he said the stuff about being in a Cold War with China, he basically had this like long, minute-long disclaimer where he was like, let me just be clear that I'm talking about like the current leadership of China under the current Communist Party. We're not talking about, you know, the Chinese diaspora. We're not talking about, you know, China, like, historically or its growth as a country or something, because...
Like, before the Global Times calls me racist.
Well, right? Yeah, that he was saying that because he was like, they'll use this as propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad that Chinese state-run media can make that claim, and then people in the United States, in Australia, in New Zealand will be like, yep, this is racist.
Well, I don't think it's just... It's not quite as simple as, like, using racism, because I think you could kind of see through that after a while. It's also using the type of nationalism, like trying to get Chinese people to feel that like these other countries, they want to bring China down. Mm. Like they don't want you to succeed because, you know, you're Chinese. Like they, like it's not just racism. I think it's also kind of appealing to this back to the Opium War kind of colonialism and all of these different things.
I would call it false nationalism. Because what the Communist Party has been very good at is conflating the concepts of China with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, ever since Mao's whole, you know, without the Communist Party, there will be no new China. This whole idea that China and the Chinese Communist Party are one and the same. And if you're against the Communist Party, you're against China. And I know we've said this many times, as pointing out this piece of propaganda, but it's so... like viral in people's minds. It's so virulent in people's minds that a lot of people, they just see people saying, oh, well, you know, China this, China that. Well, you're against China. And then they feel, overseas Chinese feel hurt by that. And a lot of, you know, what we saw in Aspen is the experts, yes, in the disclaimer, they say, I'm talking about the Chinese Communist Party. But then again, throughout their whole speech, they're just saying China, China, China. And if you are, say, an overseas Chinese and you've been, you know, just listening to clips of this, for example, you might think erroneously that they're against this concept of China, this 5,000-year culture, when obviously that's not the case if you have the context for it. But, you know, this is just another thing that you got to really watch out for.
Well, it's a good tactic because, you know, if you're the head of the FBI or the CIA and you're trying to talk about this legitimate, very serious security concern for the country, you can't even begin to discuss it without automatically being on the defensive.
It's interesting how that doesn't happen when we talk about Russia.
No, it doesn't. Now, we're not saying all Russians.
Hashtag not all Russians. Yeah, I think what's interesting, too, that's different from what the Chinese Communist Party is doing from what is happening with Russia. And the security experts brought it up again and again that, like, it's a completely different type of threat.
Yeah, they said it's a different Cold War. It's not the same as the one that we had with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Should we call this Cold War II? World War I, World War II, Cold War I, Cold War II?
I like that.
Cold War II Electric Boogaloo? Is that what you're going for?
Oh, we could. Can we trademark that? I know it? How we can fund the show.
You heard it first on China Unscripted.
We're going to fund the show by making a breakdancing movie?
I mean, how else?
Well, it was the best breakdancing movie. I mean, how did he dance on the walls and on the ceiling? It was amazing.
You actually saw Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah. Hasn't everybody?
And you criticize me for watching The Room.
Hey, I like The Room.
It's good.
Although, to be fair, you liked The Room way before it was cool.
Is it cool now?
No, but you...
If it's ever been cool, I would say we've probably reached peak Room coolness with The Disaster Artist.
Well, so anyways, for the audience, just know that I have a very interesting story about the movie The Room that we can talk about if you're ever interested in hearing that, but...
Yeah, some other time.
Let's go back to Cold War II. Now, I think it's interesting that in the context of this, they're also bringing up a lot of issues that tie into the trade war the United States is currently having with the U.S. Things about how the Chinese Communist Party manipulates foreign companies in China by trying to get them to do business with local companies, et cetera, et cetera.
I think what's interesting is when we were at the Hudson Institute, Michael Pillsbury was talking about how the Chinese Communist Party uses elite capture.
That was a good term.
Yes, like using people, like high status people like Henry Kissinger who are, you know, friends of China to, quote unquote, friends of China to spread the type of propaganda that the Communist Party wants spread. But it seems more legitimate coming from Henry Kissinger's mouth, right? Yeah. Than
basically getting influential people in, say, American society to say essentially party propaganda.
Right. Or to defend the Chinese Communist Party, you know, every time Thomas Friedman goes to China and, like, talks to a taxi driver and then comes back, like they're all the tall, shiny buildings, all they don't use cash anymore. Like, these kinds of, like, impressive things that give people, like, a very one-sided view of what's happening in China. But I think another form of elite capture is what the Chinese Communist Party is doing with these American companies.
Mm, interesting. How do you mean?
Well, I mean, who is making a lot of noise about how the trade war is going to hurt America, right?
Who?
Oh, not Hu Jintao, but, like, it's who is doing that. It's these.
Who's on first?
Oh, no.
An endless cycle.
She's on second?
Uh-huh.
It's big companies, you're saying.
Yeah, I'm saying it's, like, Tim Cook. You know, it's
or people like Jeff Bezos, who owns both a giant retailer, Amazon, and a giant media company, The Washington Post.
Right. Well, I'm thinking he's more worried about Amazon than The Washington Post. But yeah, it's these, you know, companies that have now, like, become so intertwined with the cheap labor from Chinese factories, like, maybe, like, doing business in China itself, like American auto companies.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Apple, and, like, they've had a pretty shameful past couple of weeks with China. It came out that on every single iPhone since 2017, they've programmed in Chinese censorship software where the Taiwanese flag emoji is blocked if you are if your location is set to China, to the extent that it, in some cases, causes the iPhone to crash.
You know, they're just following the relevant laws in the country, Chris.
Yes, but when the U.S. government asks them for help investigating something, it's a different story.
Well, I think it's easy to dismiss the emoji thing as just being some little emoji thing, but
that would be a mistake.
It would be a mistake because, you know, it's not like Apple came out and said, oh, by the way, just wanted to let everyone know that this is a thing that we're doing.
That we've programmed into everyone's iPhone.
Right. It's like there was a reporter who investigated this and, like, found out and then publicized it. And so how many other little censorship things is Apple doing
that we just don't know about?
I mean, we also just learned this month that Apple is going to store all of the iCloud user data for Chinese users. That is, users inside China. They're all going to be stored on a server owned by a Chinese state-run telecom company, which basically means there's almost no barrier for the Chinese police or authorities to be able to access that with the flimsiest possible warrant, which could be almost a blanket warrant that covers everything. However, they want to pretend to make it legal there. But essentially, they have access to all your iCloud data now in China.
And in the context of the United States main security offices warning that China, the Chinese Communist Party, is such a threat, you'd think companies like Apple might want to take a different stance.
I don't think they think of it as a threat to them. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, Apple has really struggled in China because of all the attacks they've suffered from state-run media criticizing the company, early morning raids at their offices and heavy fines. No, that was Microsoft that got the raids. But Apple has struggled a lot in China. We've covered it several times on the show. You can look up those old episodes.
But, you know, maybe if they, you know, are...
If they sell out a little more.
Yeah, they're the little night. They're a little more compliant. Then the Communist Party will open up the entire country and a market of 1.3 billion people to them.
Which is even technically not accurate because 1.3 billion people are not buying Apple products. It's really...
No.
Like, what, about maybe 700,000 people, which is enormous.
No, that's maybe the size of the market. That's not the number of people who have iPhones in China. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you've got, you know, roughly half the Chinese population, more than that, is still living on less than $10 a day. So it's not an overall wealthy country, but there's just such a giant population that you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of middle class people.
Or, you know, the most billionaires in the world.
Yeah, sorry. I mean hundreds of millions of middle class people. And you've got a lot of billionaires, you've got, you know, millions of millionaires. And just like the scale of that is so giant that it's very easy to look at that as the market. It's just one of those things. Also, like, Apple is so entrenched in being in China that it's like too hard now to admit that they maybe could have gone a different route.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I always say is these companies are so obsessed over these short-term gains that they ignore the long-term consequences.
And I think thought it was more like when you go to like a costume party and you show up in like this great outfit and then you realize it's not actually a costume party, but like you're dressed like that. So you just kind of like insist. You're like, you know, this is just how I want to dress.
Wait, is China the costume party? I'm confused about this analogy.
Me too.
Yeah.
Go on, Matt. We're doubling down on this. I was going to say something really cool and insightful, but no. I want to hear about this costume party.
All right. So my point is that when you when you're entrenched in something, you kind of...
Like a costume party.
Okay. Or a costume party metaphor. Okay. You just want to keep digging.
Right?
Even though it's clearly going to be to your detriment.
It's not working, but...
I know that the more I say and try to make this metaphor fit, the worse it's going to get. Like, I know that in some part of me, but I'm still doing it. Like, right now, I'm still doing it.
But in a weird way, it's actually making it work more.
Now you're in the costume party.
Wait. Whoa. All right. Before my mind explodes, let's go back to Chris's very insightful point, which
I interrupted. No, I think the Matt interrupting on a podcast, running joke. No, I think the costume analogy actually ended up working out pretty good, pretty well, pretty awesome. Shelley, do you have any analogies?
No, I'm not the analogy ninja.
No, just the humor ninja. So, Shelley, how do you think this idea of elite capture ties into the trade war that's happening?
Well, I think, you know, when people, like, let's say, you know, NBC News interviews Tim Cook about the U.S.-China trade war, you know, is that a bad thing or a good thing? What is Tim Cook going to say? You know, so, like, these people who have these entrenched interests in China, they're probably not really thinking about it from... like
a national security perspective,
right? They're thinking about what the gain or loss for their own companies are, profitability and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if Apple's gotten hacked by the Chinese Communist Party, I don't know that they have. I'm just saying that, like, it's like what you said about the short-term versus the long-term gains.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to see that, like, if you get shut out of this market, you know, there go your stock prices, then what if you lose this piece of technology?
Yeah.
You know?
And so then in the context of the trade war, these companies are providing a narrative that this is going to be very, very bad for the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be great for the United States. Like, it's a complicated thing that's going to happen.
We might need to throw a few less costume parties.
Right. Or, you know, or, like, prices at Walmart might go up. Like, there are... you know, the U.S. dollar, like, there are lots of consequences, but the idea that, like, you know, how this is going to affect the economy is not just how it affects these American companies.
Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of things that are hard to predict, like, because of, for example, the tariff on soybeans that the Chinese regime implemented. Like, everyone thought, okay, well, soybean prices are going to go up, soybean prices are going to go down because China's not going to want to buy as much, and it's going to hurt American soybean farmers. But what happened is it affected the futures market for soybeans, and a lot of other buyers were buying soybeans in bulk, which actually made the prices go back up and helped soybean farmers. So all I'm saying is sometimes it's hard to predict what the results are going to be from a specific policy.
Right. I mean, who thought about the soybeans futures?
Yeah, I didn't even think about that there would be soybean futures.
There is no future in soy. Well, so earlier you mentioned, Shelley, that the media reacted with surprise to some of these statements by Christopher Wray and Michael Collins. And now we're talking about how there's this narrative being presented by a lot of these businessmen and companies tied to China. How do you think that's affecting the media in reporting about the trade war?
It affects the media in the way that, like, if you're looking for experts who have a certain bias or a certain, you know, that's going to affect how you, like, report about it, right? But I think it's part of the thing is also that, like, a trade war is a conflict. Mm-hmm. So you always have to have, like, you know, it's kind of the way that we consume media. It's like the media want to use conflict. They want to use, like, things that are, like, you know, man bite dog stories, not dog bites man stories.
Like something that's unusual.
Yes, something unusual or the opposite than what you expect. So you're going to have, like, a lot of the trade war actually hurts the U.S. more than China, or the trade war hurts China the most, or, like, whatever the prevailing kind of idea might be, there's always going to be, like, to, you know, the people who say the opposite, partly for just, like,
novelty.
to grab the attention. So it does have an effect, but, like, there are a lot of things that are affecting the reporting on things like the trade war.
Mm. Yeah, it's also quite possible that the biggest thing that's going to happen is that the vast majority of transactions will continue as usual with almost no impact.
Currently, there's only tariffs on, what, $34 billion worth of Chinese goods?
Yeah, 34 billion. But like, what? No, but my point is that, like, you know, it's actually like there's not a big macro effect that we're actually feeling in our everyday lives. There are, like, in a small number of things, and those are what get the media attention. But, like, it's not affecting most of the stuff that's happening in this country.
Yeah, and I think even if, like, let's say we have tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese products, like, it will take time for that to kind of trickle down to whatever's going to happen with the U.S. economy.
Well, the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer has said the tariffs are part of the trade war, are proportionate and responsive to the forced technology transfer and intellectual property theft by the Chinese. Do you, in the context of Cold War II, do you think this trade war is actually playing a useful role?
I think that the U.S. government doesn't have a lot of tools to address some of the things the Communist Party is doing. So, for example, when the Chinese Communist Party steals American technology through its military hacking and so on.
Which, by the way, Chinese state-run media says totally is not happening.
Right. So, like, what tactics can the U.S. government take? Like, can we retaliate by stealing Chinese technology? And should we? I think the answer to both of those is no. So you can't fight back against that technology theft and forced technology transfer with an equal response.
Because we'd just be stealing back our own technology.
Yeah, well, the China's not coming up with nearly as much valuable technology as the U.S. is. And even so, it's not right to steal it in the first place. So you just can't retaliate with the same way. So, how many tools do we have as a government to address this issue? Like, almost none. You know, we said, oh, well, if you join the WTO, you have to follow the rules. But then they joined and they just didn't follow them. So it's just like, what do you do? You can complain to the WTO. We filed 22 complaints against China since 2001 in the WTO. Mm-hmm. It hasn't had enough of an impact to stop the things we want to stop. So you get to the point where, just like, what else is there left? So I would say doing tariffs is not perfect, but it's one of the best tools we have available. And I think there are a few others as well. One of them is what some people in the administration have started doing, which is trying to communicate to the public just how big of a threat this is. And I think that, that as that picks up and as that gets more media attention, I think that'll also have a positive impact from the American perspective.
Mm-hmm. So really, we're having a positive impact on the American public by being such outspoken.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the entire point of my saying this, is to really just say how great we are.
Yeah. Shelley, how great are we?
We are so awesome.
It's beautiful.
Was that convincing?
I think so. I'm convinced.
I'm convinced. I was already convinced.
That's true.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Well, so what do you think, Shelley? Not about how awesome we are. We know how awesome we are.
I think for definitely one of the most useful things that the tariffs are doing right now is just publicizing this whole issue. Like, the more that, like, we talk about the, you know, technology transfer and things like that are happening, the harder it is for them to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then have the plausible deniability of being like, we don't do this. Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. We talked about this earlier, but it's 2018, and this is nothing new. This has been going on for a long time.
We were just distracted.
Yeah.
Or companies were embarrassed.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, you know.
They thought they were going to a costume party, and it turned out
it was just a regular party.
It was a regular party. Yeah. And then they were in a costume, and so it was embarrassing.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, they just like, hey, look, this is how I meant to dress.
They told me it was a costume party.
I actually did that once.
Really?
Yeah, I wore a cape, and I owned it. I owned it. Capes are great. I would like to buy a high-quality cape someday. Why is that greeted by silence instead of admiration?
No,
oh,
no.
Oh, you were silently admiring.
Yes, it was silent admiration.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was that I heard something weird in my headphones, and I wasn't sure if we were like having some kind of audio technical problem. So that was seriously the reason
why. That also for me, too.
Okay, so, all right, let's do it again. So I think capes are great, and I want to buy a high-quality cape now that we're not distracted by technical things.
Well, Chris, I think that if you want to get a high-quality cape, you should buy one. And when we're not together, you can wear it.
I could recommend a good Etsy seller.
What's Etsy?
Etsy?
Wait, hold on. Nobody's paying us any money, so.
Oh, it's like an online marketplace, so they wouldn't really pay. But, you know, it's like.
Etsy, if you'd like to be sponsored on China Unscripted.
No, there's no way that they would sponsor us. It's basically like a bunch of individual artists and craftspeople who sell stuff. It's like a.
Yeah, you could sell stuff on Etsy.
Like, so it's like a farmer's market, but for the internet.
Yeah, so it's art. Like yeah. It's like eBay for handmade stuff.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gosh, we're really talking them up. Are you sure they can't give us money?
I don't know. I'm
fairly sure that's not going to happen.
Fine. All right. Other interesting things that have happened recently. There's been rumors in China about an attempted coup against Xi Jinping, which I think is super sexy. You're thinking
awkward
about the capes. I know.
Silence. Yeah.
I know. All right. Take a moment. Yes, Chris in a cape would look awesome. Feel free to draw that, fans of this. But
I was just trying to imagine in my mind a kind of sexy coup d'etat where Jiang Zemin is wearing a cape. It's not working at all. It's just a total mess.
He's kind of becoming like an anime villain in my mind now.
Well, because I think of Jiang Zemin as being kind of like Skeletor.
He had a cape. I'm
yeah.
pretty sure.
Yeah, no, yeah. He did actually. So you can bring the cape back
like
into this.
It was more like a cowl. He had like, it had a hood.
Yeah.
Cape,
yeah.
Cowls are
so,
kind of
so, good. Yeah, so the rumors are that former Chinese leader Jiang Zemin, who looks like Skeletor.
Well, the problem is now I'm imagining Jiang Zemin in the Skeletor cowl, which then necessitates the Xi Jinping is He-Man in the He-Man
briefs.
Well,
no, this is too weird. No. Maybe Xi Jinping is the tiger?
No, because he's hunting down the tigers and the flies.
Okay.
Well, so Xi Jinping is He-Man.
Yeah.
This is getting real weird.
No,
wait,
it works.
Wait, no. Xi Jinping should be She-Ra.
Oh, thank you,
Come
Shelley.
On.
Done.
She-Ra. All right. What did she wear? More clothes than He-Man. That's
like
for sure.
A little bit. Like marginally. Like she had a bustier, so that's better.
Actually, I'm realizing that Sean Connery in the movie Zardoz basically was dressed like He-Man. You know Zardoz?
No.
Oh.
China Uncensored Movie Night? Is that what I'm hearing?
I've never successfully watched all of Zardoz. Any of you listening, though, if you know Zardoz.
Well,
is it too bad for you?
I mean, when there are...
No judgment here, because I watched Electric Boogaloo.
That's true. Well, as they say in Zardoz, the gun is good, the penis is evil.
What?
Look, Sean Connery is essentially spends a movie dressed like He-Man. In other words, he's got red briefs on, and that's about it.
Uh-huh.
He encounters a giant flying stone head, and then it kind of goes from there.
Was this made in the 80s?
When was it made? It was made by the guy, I think, who did Deliverance. It was like he made Deliverance. It was a huge success. And so the studio was like, okay.
Whatever
you want. And this is what he came up with.
Wow.
It's like how the guy who made Donnie Darko, that did really great. And so the studio was like, all right, anything you want. And then he made Southland Tales, which I bet none of you have seen because it is one of the worst pieces of garbage I have ever seen, including having Justin Timberlake in it, but like making him like scarred up and ugly. Which you don't do that if you have Justin Timberlake in your movie. It stars The Rock. I bet he wants to forget that one. Sarah Michelle Gellar. That was really.
It sounds like a 90s fever dream.
It certainly felt like a fever dream. Oh.
Wait, what were we talking about?
Gosh, there was a coup attempt. Well, rumors of a coup attempt. China.
So there are a few different rumors. There was the rumor that there were gunshots heard, right? And then the separate...
In the center of Beijing.
Yeah, in Beijing. And then the separate rumor that directly involved Jiang Zemin was that some party elders, like Jiang Zemin, former leader Jiang Zemin, former leader Hu Jintao, and Zhu Rongji, who was
like the premier in the 90s.
People like that were kind of banding up because they were disapproving of what he was doing.
Becoming
and they were
a strong man.
Yeah, blah, and then, blah, blah. Then they were going to... There was this secret Politburo meeting on the evening of Friday the 13th of July. In Beijing, where they were going to force Xi to do certain...
To step down
and then force certain people Wang Yang was going to take over the military. There was all these weird rumors.
Yeah.
It was kind of,
Well, rumors play a pretty big role in China because with the Communist Party having such an iron grip on all of the media, rumors are sort of a way for people to have an alternative narrative to what's going on in party politics. So.
Or to, people spend a lot of time trying to parse the rumors and be what's true, what's not. If this rumor is not true, but what could it mean?
Which is exactly what we're doing right now.
Yes.
Essentially, did somebody create this rumor as part of a distraction or a strategy?
Yeah, well, that's what you get when you're staring into a black box. If anything could be anything.
It's really a lot of fun. But yeah, in the past, some rumors have proven true. When Xi Jinping first came to power in 2012, there were rumors that there were gunshots heard in Zhongnanhai.
Or some people saw tanks.
Tanks in Beijing, can you imagine? And that it was always a way for the Jiang faction to try and overthrow Xi Jinping.
Or it was at the time, it was more specifically that had something to do with Bo Xilai and Zhou Yongkang. And it was a crazy time, 2012.
Oh boy, when we started the show. But then several years later, they did kind of, or a Communist Party official did kind of say that yes, there were these coup attempts and these officials were tied to it.
Yeah, I mean, it may not have been as sexy as tanks rolling down the street, but
you find that sexy?
Well, I was using Chris's original. How we got into this whole thing about the sexy coup, and then you started thinking about Jiang Zemin as Skeletor, and then we got into Zardoz or whatever.
We got into Zardoz. Let's make a rule: never get to Zardoz in a podcast. We need more structure.
Anyway, so you know, there may not have been tanks rolling down the street of Beijing, but that, like, there were, like, plots, right, mm-hmm. against Xi Jinping or, like, you know.
Yeah. And so with the current rumors, it seems next to impossible that Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao would ever team up, because they were basically enemies. Enemies in a very similar way that Xi Jinping and Jiang Zemin are enemies. The only difference is Hu Jintao didn't have any real power to fight back.
You know, once a guy takes some pot shots at you when you're standing on a destroyer, that can kind of, like, put a chill on the relationship.
Sour,
yeah.
The relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no, I understand. Like, I'm not friends with any of the people who've tried to assassinate me.
Yeah, I don't know. But, like, that's the problem with the Chinese Communist Party. There's, like, no good mentorship structure, you know?
That's true. Well, I hear they're trying to bring back Mao's brain as a computer overlord.
Oh. Have they been watching, like, The Avengers?
I was going to say
Zardoz. That. Yeah. But what's interesting about this rumor in particular is it takes the core idea, which is very probable, people tied to Jiang Zemin trying to overthrow Xi Jinping, because that's basically what happens. But then adding this ridiculous element on top of it that kind of makes it seem like the whole thing is ridiculous.
Well, I think if you actually wanted to deconstruct whether this rumor was true, you would also do things like look at whether there could have been a secret Politburo meeting convened in Zhongnanhai on the evening of the 13th. And some Chinese, like, political commentators do stuff like that, like, where they're like, okay, well, if you look at the People's Daily, like, this is where this official was, this is where this official was, like, some of them were out of the country, you know what I mean? Mm. So, like, it was like, oh, well, like, it's probably unlikely that there was, like, a meeting. You know, so, like, there's ways to kind of deconstruct rumors and see if, like, it seems at all plausible.
And this is the world of China news.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we sort through to make stuff for you guys.
Well, actually, if you can understand Chinese, like, it's pretty crazy, the internal stuff that you know, like, because I listen to some Chinese YouTubers who, like, kind of look more at internal party politics. And yeah, the rumors are, like, everybody got excited about them, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot more stuff going on, because in another few weeks the Communist Party is going to be going on their annual summer retreat.
To, fun time.
Yes, to Beidaihe, which is, like, a resort in the northeast of China. And, like, that's where every August the Communist Party leadership goes, and mm-hmm. they have, like, their little secret meetings.
They have the annual boat race where they try and beat the rich kids over at Vietnam.
Uh-huh. It's very much like a summer camp. You get to see unfortunate photos of the party leaders swimming.
Nice. A proud tradition.
Do you remember the photo of Jiang in the water?
When he looks like a frog?
Yeah, well, he's like...
Well, to be fair, he looks like a frog in a lot of...
Well, he's like wearing a swim cap and goggles, and he's wearing swim trunks, and he's like on his back. Yeah, it's like
just
too much.
Just think of Zardoz. Sean Connery and Zardoz. That's his better image.
Yeah, and then, like, it's like, it's almost like he's, like, blowing water out of his mouth or something. Like, yeah. It's very...
There were some pretty nasty photos of Mao swimming, too.
Oh, like, yeah, I've seen them.
Maybe it is sort of, like, a callback to Mao, because Mao was very adamant about, like, physical fitness, and, like, he swam a lot. It's weird to think of him in physical fitness since he devolved into Jabba the Hutt.
Uh-huh. You know, swimming a lot, but not brushing your teeth. That mm-hmm. takes it too far.
No, don't want to do that.
No, Mao had a technique, which was that he'd swish his mouth out with tea every night, mm-hmm. Which he believed would be enough.
Mm-hmm. Also, sleeping with virgins, that was the secret to extending his life.
Yeah, well, in a way, he's at least extended the life of his body. It's now been preserved in... Tiananmen Square for, like, you know,
life is a strong word for that.
Yeah. Funny story about the Mao mummy. The Soviets had kind of perfected that technology with it was Lenin, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had built this kind of glass sarcophagus for Lenin, and they wanted to do that for Mao. But at that point, the Soviets and the Chinese Communist Party were not really seeing eye to eye, which is an understatement. So the Chinese Communist Party tried to do it themselves, and they didn't quite get the technology right. So, like, the Mao mummy is not well preserved.
Yeah, like, I went to see it one time. This is like 2002, and it was like very yellowed, and like his skin was kind of pulled back in a weird way. I don't know what it looks like now. They might have been able to improve it, or
it's just like,
or it's actually like a wax figure. Uh-huh. Like I wouldn't be that surprised if it was just a complete fake at this point.
Mm-hmm. Just like the mangoes.
Yeah, just like the mangoes. And then also, what's fun? So I waited like in line for about an hour and a half to get into the mausoleum in Tiananmen Square. And then, like, they shuffle you through, and they've got police guards there. And you get out the other end, and it's, like, this gift shop where you buy, like, all sorts of kitschy, like, Mao watches. And,
Disneyland strategy.
Yeah, no, it's just, like, it's really this weird universe where, you know, the
communists. Could you buy, like, a fake preserve Mao in, like, a little, like, mini miniature Mao?
No, you couldn't, but it was just weird that, like, you know, this great communist to now buy his image on all this stuff.
You know, socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Yeah, Mao would be rolling over in his glass case if you saw it. I don't know.
It's a world of revolutionary fever. It's a world of collectivized farming.
Worst that Disney ride ever.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yep, and onto the table. Well, speaking of rides that seem to go on forever, I think it's about time that we end this ride. And by this ride, I'm using an analogy to refer to this podcast.
Wait, I don't understand the analogy. Are you in a costume or not?
So it's like you're wearing a costume.
Okay.
Okay. And then there's a giant floating head. And then there's Xi Jinping dressed as She-Ra.
Uh-huh.
And then we wrap up the podcast.
And then you buy a cape? What?
It's a cape with Mao's face on the back that you get after you've seen his corpse.
Okay. Well, yeah. I think we've managed to wrap everything up very well.
Nice, neat little bow. So thanks for listening to this podcast of China Unscripted. Be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube or Stitcher or iTunes.
Spotify,
thank you.
Or watch us on our website at chinaunscripted.com.
Yeah. And if anyone knows where to buy a nice cape, let me know.
Yeah, I guess leave your cape suggestions in the comments below.
Thanks again for listening. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
See you next time.
We're not going to see them.
Well, we won't even listen to you. You'll listen to us next time. That sounded like a threat.